Welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast, your weekly dose of knife news and information about knives and knife collecting. Here's your host, Bob the Knife Junkie DeMarco.
Welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast. I'm Bob DeMarco. On this edition of the show, I'm speaking with Justin Burton of War Crown Forge. Justin is a bladesmith I've been following for a few years now, and I'd say what attracts me most about his work is its ties to the past. Justin's knives, swords, and other implements of chaos harken back to the historical, the mythological, and even the fantasy realms, but they always look beautiful, practical, and deadly. It seems obvious from just looking at videos of Justin's work, which is the only exposure I've had thus far, that he is a very accomplished maker and skilled smith. We'll find out what inspires Justin to make these impressive weapons, but first, be sure to like, comment, and subscribe. Hit the notification bell and download the show to your favorite podcast app. That way you can listen on the go. And as always, if you want to help support the show, you can do so on Patreon. Quickest way to get there is to go to theknifejunkie.com/Patreon. Again, that's theknifejunkie.com/Patreon.
Get cash back for shopping. theknifejunkie.com/cashback.
If you search Google for the best knife podcast, the answer is The Knife Junkie Podcast.
Justin, welcome to the show, sir.
Thanks for having me on.
It's my pleasure. Pleasure is mine. You know, I was kind of cramming on War Crown Forge today, getting ready for the interview, and I saw on Instagram that post of Jason Statham sitting on the stoop of his trailer on the set of Expendables 4, pawing some of your knives. How did that happen?
Dude, that's actually a pretty funny story. That was like 16 months in the works. And as awesome as that was, it kills me because any maker, I don't care what you're doing or what you're making, you're constantly getting better, always getting better, always evolving, always, advancing. And so I had made those blades, like I said, like 16 months ago. And then the post comes out. And I was like, I'm looking at those blades and they just look so terrible to me. And I'm like, oh no.
Oh,
but, yeah. I had managed, it was mostly thanks to my wife. She had gotten in touch with his, one of his, personal assistants. And while they're talking, I ended up getting in touch with Jason. And I was like, hey man, I'd love to make you and send you a knife, you know, love your movies. And I sent him like 3 knives personally that he owns of mine. And then, yeah, he asked me, he's like, hey, you know, we're going to be shooting Expendables 4, send me some knives. And it was like so, and then it just like disappeared. Nothing happened. I didn't hear anything for months and months and months and months. Next thing you know, they're like, hey, can you ship some knives to Greece in a week? And so I like, you know, I dropped everything and knocked them out as fast as possible. And that's so, to my knowledge, that's him on the set in Greece. Checking out the knives after they've been received by the prop master. And, it was pretty incredible. I don't know. I watched the movie. I don't know if they actually made it into the movie. They told me they received them. They said they loved them. Yada, yada, yada. But I don't know if they actually made it into the film. I didn't see them in there, but it was really cool that he had them and that he posted about me. Super kind of him. He definitely didn't have to do that. So it was really fun. Just as a fan of his stuff, that was cool for me.
Oh, no doubt. And I think it's a clever way to have a really sweet knife collection. I know for a fact Sylvester Stallone is a knife collector, and I know Jason Statham's the knife guy in The Expendables. So, No, I'm just kidding. But I was curious as to whether you actually made dull versions for it, like stage versions, or you just sent him.
So I asked him about that, and I was like, hey, you know, you want me to put, you know, a blank edge on these, you know, like dull them down and everything. They're like, no, just send them how you normally would. We have a prop master here who will take care of them if we need to. So that was,
wow.
that was pretty crazy. And so like I sent them out there, razor sharp.
Well, so, how did you get into this? You got your knives in the hands of some big knife collectors, some big stars, but, how'd you get started?
Honestly, I'm a really big nerd. So I'm constantly, just waist deep in, you know, comic books, fantasy fiction, and stuff of that ilk. And I always wanted to forge and make my own knives and swords. I've been collecting them since I was a kid, and I just never really, you know, buying store-bought ones, I could never find things that I actually really liked. And so I was like, you know, once I finally was stationary long enough at one point in my life, I was like, all right, I'm going to try it out and see how it goes. And I just never stopped. I've been doing it now pushing 8 years, I think. So yeah, this is I absolutely love every bit about it. It's been fantastic.
So, I mean, we'll find out about how you learned and everything, but first, the important questions, which movies, do you think had the best swords, and, what inspired you? I mean, I'll give you, for instance, when I was a kid, it was Conan the Barbarian. I mean, by far the best sword.
Conan the Barbarian is great. I really like, so I've always been a massive fan of rapier style swords and sweat hilts. And so, you know, basically any Three Musketeers movie or Legend of Zorro movie or, you know, all those where they had the basket hilts or the sweat hilts or the small sword, all those different things, which most of those were all made by one dude out of Burbank, Tony Swatton, I believe. He made like almost every movie sword you've ever seen for like the last 20 years. But yeah, I love all kinds. And then I think, but biggest, best sword total, it's hard to beat Lord of the Rings, man. It's just,
oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because there's a dozen different epic swords made. Weta Works did an amazing job making all the props. And they did some really cool, unique stuff, and there's just so many of them, you know, of all different designs and sets, you know.
Yeah, and you know, as I mentioned up front, you were also inspired by mythology, and you look at Lord of the Rings, and there are all these different races in Lord of the Rings with all their different mythologies and different blade designs and stuff like that. That's what's so cool to me about that series. It's so complex.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you 100%. Yeah, you have wildly different structures and setups and lines and flows to, you know, between elves, dwarves, humans, you know, everything. It's hard to beat that movie for, like, it's just massive representation of, like, you know, anything you could possibly want.
So when you started, you just dived right in and went right for forging, I take it. What was your learning like early on?
Oh man, my learning. Right, so this is why my number one piece of advice whenever I get asked now how to start is spend the money and take a class. Trust me, it'll save you years. Don't do it the way I did it. No, I had, like, you know, a 55-gallon drum filled with charcoal and powered by a mattress blower and was just out there just hammering around on, you know, leaf spring on a piece of railroad rail, which is like how most smiths seem to start unless they go the class route. Every guy that took a class or paid to learn from some guy, they bypassed me by 2 years, you know, because that first 2 years, I was just like a Neanderthal, just like playing around in the muck. Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, it's not self-taught, because if you're reading books or you're watching videos, you know, you're not teaching yourself, you're learning from other people. So, it's definitely, you know, like I was scrounging, you know, reading anything I could and watching any videos I can. But even still, when you don't know what's right and what's wrong, as far as, you know, blacksmithing, bladesmithing goes, all the information, it's just an information overload. You know, you don't know who's right and who's full of it.
Right.
So that, like I said, that slowed me down by an easy 2 years compared to some of the guys I know, have been doing it half as long as I have been and are better than me because they spent, you know, a couple grand to take a class here and there in their first year. So worth it.
I would imagine, especially with something like bladesmithing, a lot of the benefit of having a class and learning from a master smith or someone at least who's been doing it a long time is that with blade smithing, it seems like there is a certain amount of feel to it. Something that you can't quite write down or quantify exactly. For instance, a couple of times I've observed bladesmiths, you know, going in the dark and checking the color and things like that seem to me like a feel thing that you pick up from being around people who know what they're doing, kind of like a musician would pick up the feel of a song by playing with other musicians.
Oh, absolutely. You can take 100 Smiths and ask them all the same question, and you're gonna get 80 different answers. Everyone's got their own little twist on, you know, you got the approved method, and then everyone just like, well, I did it this way, well, I used this instead, or I had this, or there was a solar eclipse when I did it. Everyone's got their own twist on what they think is the best way. The best advice is test everything and check your results.
Yeah. So do you have any examples of your work that you can hold up right now so that we know what we're talking about as we continue the conversation?
So I'm working on a handful of things. So I have got grief about this because I tend not to keep too many of my pieces. I've only kept, like, I've got two that I've kept, and then I've got some pieces in process. So I got this is one I recently finished, which is an integral holster chef knife.
This is not typical for you, is it?
That is not. So this one I went and took the class on because it was something I wanted to learn more.
Wow.
Because I don't do integral bolster knives that often. And as a matter of fact, I'm not that big of a fan of them. I appreciate the talent and skill it takes to make them, and I want to get better at them. But it's not something that gets my creative juices flowing, as it were. But man, it's definitely something you need to know how to make if you're going to be bladesmithing. They're too big. They're too popular to not at least know how to make them.
Yeah. Well, well, first of all, before I get to that, I can see the profile in that, sort of echoing some of the profiles of your like big Bowies, that I've seen. Making a chef's knife, you know, when you held it up and were kind of turning it in your hand, you could see how very thin it is. That's gotta be, you know, especially for someone who's forging swords, and I would imagine your swords are quite fine and everything. But still, I would imagine the chef's knives are thinner by quite a lot. That must be a whole new skill.
No, doing chef knives, and I have a huge world of respect for the guys that do it, like, you know, full time, the chef knives, or that's their passion. It is definitely not mine, but, making chef knives is a whole nother ball game because it's, you know, that's why the S grind is now becoming so popular, because, you know, people have, you know, what they consider to be like an excellent cut is something that doesn't hold. You know, if you slice through a vegetable, they don't want it to stick to the blade. They want it to fall away.
Wait. Describe the S grind. What's the S grind?
And I may be butchering this, but the S grind, essentially is where they take a big contact wheel and they hollow grind in a big swath in the middle of the blade, and then they come in and they grind a flat grind for the primary bevel, and so that you get this kind of this so the idea behind that, I believe, and I could be wrong, I'm often wrong, is when you're cutting through some food, that creates that air gap where the food falls away from what you're cutting, like doesn't stick to the chef knife. So I believe that's the entire purpose of it. And that is another thing that's been wildly popular over the last year and a half. People making those S grinds. They, as a matter of fact, now they specifically sell curved flattens for grinders now.
Oh, wow. It looks cool too, I would imagine. I mean, I'm not sure if I've seen that exactly, but.
Especially if it's a mosaic or a pattern welded, you know, Damascus, where it really augments the pattern, you know, the grinding of the patterns to reveal a look you don't normally see. So yeah, it can look quite fantastic.
Before we leave your chef's knife, you're talking about how it's an integral bolster knife. Just describe what that is and how that's special.
Yeah, so you have the integral bolster, meaning that the bolster area of the knife is forged from the same homogeneous steel on the bill, as you can see that it is one continuing piece. This one was like a little special edition because the billets that we used for this in the class were made by the guys over at Baker Forge and Tool, and they had TIG welded these copper Damascus billets on. You can really see a little bit of that copper, which is really awesome of them.
That's cool. Well, so this is not the kind of thing you make ordinarily. What is the kind of thing you make ordinarily?
So the kind of thing I make a lot of EDCs. I make a lot of little EDC blades.
Beautiful Tonto.
Yep, the little Tonto EDC. And then the stuff that I love making is something I currently have in process. One isn't finished yet, but I like making the big ridiculous fantasy stuff, or you know, something that's got a little flair of history mixed with a whole lot of fantasy.
Wow!
So this is a big piece I'm working on. I actually had the privilege recently to go up and forge with the guys at Baker Forge and Tool, and forge some of my own copper Damascus sand mine, and that is what I'm turning it into. I wanted to make something crazy out of it, something huge out of it.
Man, that is gorgeous. I mean, I am very much in love with that profile. Like, I love a clip point. I love a Bowie blade. I love a recurve. That kind of horse hoof handle you're using there. You described that as sort of fantasy. To me, I saw that as as exotic. I guess they're kind of similar.
Yeah,
similar.
Yeah, you got a little bit of a Persian flair to it. You know, anytime you take something historical and then make it, you know, you blow certain parts out of proportion, or you make it way bigger or longer than it was, or fatter than it was. You know, you change up, you take away where it was in history, and you're adding, you know, make believe to it to a certain degree. You know, something, you know, fantasy oriented, I guess.
Well, I mean, it's a little bit like your interpretation of the Tonto. You were just holding up your EDC. You know, it's a broader, stouter version of a historical knife.
Absolutely. We definitely agree. So, a little bit.
So how would you describe your process? Is everything you make pattern weld Damascus? Tell me about how you go about making a knife.
So it really depends. So I do this full time now. I've been doing it full time for almost 2 years now. Nice. I've been making for almost 8 years. So you know, you have blades that sell quickly, that pay the bills, and that would be these kind of blades, right? You know, your EDC blades, your everyday carry items, your smaller, like 4-inch blades or shorter, tend to be your quick sells, what pays the bills. And then you have like the larger pieces. So it really depends on what it is, you know. So there'll be, if I'm doing a large batch of small blades, there'll be, you know, batches of stock removed blades, which is where you're cutting out the shape of a knife shape out of steel, and then heat treating it and refining it, and then turning it into a functional knife. And then you have the ones that I'm more passionate about, which is when I get, you know, either a large blade or a custom ordered blade, and I get to take it to the anvil and forge something out and shape something there, and then bring it into, you know, life after the forging process. So.
Well, okay. Jim just had your website up there, and the last shot we saw was of you holding a Kopesh. And I've seen you, you make wakizashis. You made this beautiful Gladius not too long ago that was just...
Oh, yeah. The tactical Gladius. Yeah.
I mean, I could justify that easily by saying I'm Italian and I'm buying that.
There you go. There you go.
but you were mentioning the EDCs sell quicker. Those, first thing that popped into my head, those are the easiest things to justify. Especially if you're learning about a new maker, getting into a new maker, or you don't have maybe as much money to spend on something larger, but also you got to justify it to the other people in your life. Say your wife, you know, oh, well, I carry it every day, babe, you know, or I take it to work, and then ease that person into the larger.
It's the crippling debt of knife collecting.
Yeah. Yeah, it is an ever spiraling. So with the Gladius, with the Wakizashis, I've seen you make a lot of those. the large kukri, that kind of thing. Are those knives that are short swords and knives that you decide to make on your own because that's just, you know, what you're burning to make? Or are these the kind of things that are more commission based?
Well, so the modern wakizashi that I make, the battle wok, it's actually kind of funny. I did not expect those to be as popular as they were. It kind of surprised me. I wanted to make some, and I thought, and how that evolved was, I was in my shop, and this was years ago, and I was in there, and I wanted to make a, you know, a katana style smaller blade of wakizashi. But at that point in time, I wasn't very good at doing hidden tangs. I wasn't very good at doing guards, and I'm a perfectionist when it comes to my stuff within the realm of what I'm capable of. So like doing guards that don't have like perfectly clean fit ups make me want to slam my head against the wall. You know, so like, so I hold myself to such a high standard when it comes to certain things that I'm like, okay, well, I'm not going to do that yet because I'm not good enough to do that yet. I'm going to hold off and build those skills. So what can I make? And so the modern wakizashi, the tactical battle wok, was born because I wanted something really bad that kind of fit that criteria as far as shape, design, functionality, and comfortability. But without having, you know, a 12-piece handle setup, something that someone could easily have one tactical style handle material and still be, have their hand protected, still utilize it and enjoy it. And I made the first couple ones and they were a hit. And I've made so many I can make those, blindfolded in my sleep now. I never would have expected them to be as popular as these games. And so now I throw in, you know, like the, and so that kind of spiraled me into like, you know, like what other classics that I love can I make a modern tactical version of? And I've always, kukris are my favorite blade shape.
Ooh, yeah.
Kukris are by far my favorite blade shape. And so I'm always trying to find a way to make, you know, either an EDC version or a functional smaller version or something just, you know, crazy big.
These are really cool. Jim is scrolling through your page and I'm just, drooling, I guess I'd say. But, you're talking about, kukris and making small pocketable versions. That sax is unreal. I love that. That's amazing. Do you find a certain special challenge in shrinking down a kukri?
I do. So, like, I made the EDC kukri, and I still make those quite a bit. I really enjoy them. When it comes to an EDC, and I always tell customers this too. I always tell them. I said, if you're gonna spend the money on buying a custom knife, and I don't care if it's from me or any other maker out there, if you're gonna drop custom knife money, get something crazy. You know, get something that you're gonna want, because what are we all gonna do? Any knife you have, any firearm, anything that you collect, as soon as someone you guys see, look at this. You gotta see what I just got. You gotta see it. We wanna show our friends, we wanna show people. Get something gnarly, you know? Get something, you know. Yeah. So that's another reason. So I wanna bring these blade shapes that a lot of people only buy if they're like, you know, a large version, and I wanna make something. Like I said, if the EDCs is going to sell on a more regular basis or more people can afford it, I'd love to make something, you know, for everyone that is at least in an affordable size for them as well. You know, if they can't necessarily buy a big, you know, 10-inch blade.
Yeah, I've seen you do sort of the, well, your small EDC kukri has the ring, right?
It has. Yeah, obviously.
And then also I saw a dagger, a ringed dagger you make. Or it could have been a custom, or I mean, just a one-off. But doing the ringed things—that's a real challenge. Do you drift every one of those rings? How does?
No, God no, God no, no. So my rule of thumb when it comes to this is: if I can forge the original, if I know how to forge it, if I can competently forge what I'm making, then I've got no problem doing a stock and move piece. The ring pieces actually came from some advice from Jason Knight. I was actually, he actually, you know, he took me off my pedestal a little bit, and I thank him for it. It was a prideful thing I kind of had in my mind. So I was in his shop talking with him, and he's just wildly successful at what he does. He's an amazing maker, and he's inspired me for years. But I was in there talking. He's like, "Man, it looks like you're making a bunch of your ringback knives." And I'm like, "Oh yeah, you know, I'm working on them nonstop." And he's like, "Oh, have you gotten any of the blanks water jetted out?" And I was like, you know, I made a face like, no, I'm doing it. And he's like, "Why? Don't you have a family to feed? Or don't you?" He's like, "Are you growing that big? Could you benefit from having some?" And I was like, "Well, yeah, I really could benefit from having some because I am pouring, you know, I am full saw cutting out every ring knife. I am, you know, doing all those just to keep up with orders, just to keep up with production. And, you know, I'm just one guy in my garage." And so about a year ago, I started, you know, water jetting out, just my ring blanks. And that, that made it so I had more time to work on, you know, like passion projects or bigger pieces. Because now, you know, anything with a ring on the back, I could just, you know, fulfill that order a lot quicker.
So did Jason Knight give you the idea or did he give you the permission, so to speak?
Oh, honestly, I knew other people were doing it. It was like a prideful thing. Once again, where I was, so I'm currently out and I live in East Tennessee now. And where I was before that, for like the first 6 years that I was doing this, I was living in the middle of nowhere in Arizona. And I knew like one other smith and we chatted occasionally, but there were no other bladesmiths around anywhere near me. You know, I had no one to bounce ideas off of, see what other smiths are doing, see what other makers are doing. And out here, I'm drowning in them. They're everywhere. I could throw a stone and hit four. And like I said, Jason was real close to me. And so it was kind of like having someone that I looked up to be like, "Wow, you're being an idiot. You know, something's so stupid and prideful." And I'm like, "Oh, well, you know, maybe I will, you know, maybe I am being." And so I just kind of took a second look at my process and what I was making and what I needed to do. And I was like, "Yep, yeah, I'm being stupid." And yes.
Or I'm being smarter. Yeah. I mean, I think that is the typical business model, I would say at this point, from the people that I've spoken with who are primarily bladesmiths. You know, you have a couple of really in-demand models, usually the smaller ones that you can kind of make in a more, I don't want to say automated, because it's not automated. You're just having them cut out and then you're doing, but you can have them done quicker, more efficiently.
Yeah, in a more production-like setup. Yeah.
So, when you do, a run of, kukris with the rings, for instance, what do you call those, by the way?
So the ones with the rings that are kind of a curious, that's my Hermes model.
Oh, nice. Oh, okay. So your Hermes model, for instance, if you're going to do a run of those, do you wait for orders to build up and then you do a bunch of them? Or do you say, "Hey, I'm going to do a run. If you want in, you have until October or something"?
So I'm just now starting to kind of transition into making batches of blades and then dropping them for people to purchase. Which is kind of new and kind of scary for me because I normally operated in about a 50-50, market as, 50% custom orders that are on my custom order books that I'm constantly working on to clear. And the other 50% making a blade and posting it for sale, you know, making one blade and putting it up for sale. And then when it sells, you know, making something else. And so I'd make blades in batches. So I'd have like 3 or 4 custom orders on my books. And I'd make those simultaneously as like 2 other blades that I was going to put up for sale. And so I'll just be working, you know, back and forth on all 5 blades until the orders are finished and then post the other 2 for sale. But just now in the last, you know, couple weeks, I'm transitioning into trying to clear as many custom orders as I can and get to dropping custom batches of blades for people to purchase.
What are you expecting that to change for you in terms of being an artist?
Well, I mean, knock on wood, my biggest complaint I get is, "Hey, your website sold out. There's nothing on your website." And And the reason for that is I'm caught in like a custom order loop. You know, I'm booked about 4 months out currently, and I've been booked 4 months out for the last year, which, I mean, that's not a bad thing. That's a blessing. But it's just like, I'm just constantly catching up on orders and never having time. And you know, a lot of people, you know, it makes them nervous to custom order a blade and wait 4 months. I get it. I understand. You know, especially if you're new to buying custom knives. You know, that might seem sketchy as heck, you know? Might see it sound like I'm trying to scam someone. If I'm like, yes, please give me, you know, hundreds of dollars and then wait 4 months to hear from me, you know?
Yeah.
So I want that to be an option for people that if they want to pop onto the website and buy something right then, right now for a reasonable price and not have to wait, you know, all the power to them.
Yeah, yeah. And it also makes you a more varied company. You know, it makes you a wider ranging, offering. And if you don't get them with the Wakizashi, you can get them with an EDC. You know, I think that's
there you go.
It seems to be a smart way to go about it. You were in the Navy, I know. Thank you for your service. How did that affect your love of knives? Did that have anything to do with where you are today in terms of knife making?
When I was in the military, I bounced all around. I didn't start making knives until I had already been out of the military for several years. So I got out in 2010 and I made my first knife in 2016, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it was quite a span, and that was because I moved around so much. I was like a nomad. I didn't live anywhere long enough where I could build up tool. Everything I owned fit in the bed of, you know, a truck. And so, like, I didn't have any tools or anything that I could build up to actually start, you know, making a forge to, you know, try this out on. And, it wasn't until I had moved to Arizona where I was finally stationary long enough where, you know, the wife was like, why don't you finally give it a go? But I was like, all right, go for it. We'll see what happens.
So. God, running a forge in Arizona.
I'm golden now out here. This is easy weather now out here. People are always like, the humidity here. But I'm like, have you ran a forge at 145 degrees?
So you said that when you started forging, you were with a 55-gallon drum full of charcoal. And,
It was so bad.
so seeing progress or works in process videos from your Instagram feed, obviously you have seriously outfitted your shop. What has changed since becoming, besides like that kind of thing, but what has changed since becoming a full-time knife maker, just in for you in the process?
Oh man, it's like getting to be like Willy Wonka, man. I every day I get to wake up and don't get me wrong, I expect it to all come crashing down at any moment. The novelty and blessing of what I have going on right now is not lost on me. It's unbelievable. I get to wake up, I get to be with my wife and kid and hang out, and then I walk downstairs into the garage and start doing something I'm absolutely passionate about. And, you know, it's always varied because, I mean, you've got the job or hobby or passion of bladesmithing. There's so much varied and involved into it. You're not just doing the same, you know, you've got candle making and woodworking involved in it. You've got metallurgy involved in it. You've got forging involved in stock removal, design, geometry, grinding. There's a million little things. And I am so far away from where I want to be skill wise. Like, there's guys that just make me look like a child. They're so skilled and talented at doing this. And, you know, I'm constantly, you know, I've got a laundry list of things I want to learn, and I've been ticking away at it for the last 8 years. You know, it's just, and, you know, in, you know, 20 more years, I might get there. But, no, it's amazing. Getting to, you know, drop what I'm doing to push my kid on the swing. And then go back into the shop and continue grinding the blade. That's a blessing.
Oh yeah, No doubt. I mean, so I want to take exception to one thing you said. You said you realize that this is a novelty and it could all come crashing down. I totally understand what you mean. It's not too many people who get to live their passion, and it's always good to be cautiously optimistic about anything. But I look at it differently. I see what you have and what you've built, your skills, that is, and your shop, as an eternal skill. That's like something that doesn't go away, the need for that. You know, things, everything we have right now in modern society could become null and void, but making blades and knowing how to manipulate metal and harden metal for whether it's knives, swords, or plows, or whatever it is, always a necessary skill needed by everyone all around.
No, I 100% agree with you. And like, you know, I always say this is, even if this all went belly up tomorrow and I never was able to sell another blade, I'd still be in there making blades in my free time. I'd just be selling them, you know, or I'd just be giving them away then. I'd still be making it because I absolutely love doing it. I'd be selling them for the cost of material just so I could keep making them then. You know, I've tried my hand at a lot of hobbies, and I was bad at all of them. this is one that I not only I've taken to, but I thoroughly love it. So.
Well, I was going to ask you that. Like, have you always been someone who's handy or capable, creative with his hands? No,
not even a little bit.
Well, then how is it? You must have just lucked into your one good thing.
I know how to do a little bit of a lot of stuff. I have worked at a lot of different jobs, awesome ones and nightmare ones, and but I've never been like mechanically inclined. I'm not good at woodworking except for doing a handle on a knife. You know, like I'm not good. You know, I don't play instruments well. I've got butter fingers. I've tried a lot of different stuff. I think this clicks for me because, I'm such a nerd about it because I'm passionate about the end result. And so, my passion for the end result, it just fuels, you know, pushes me past all the other things that would normally make me stumble. And, you know, makes me, look at them. It's like selective learning, you know? It's hard, if you're not into math, it's hard to pay attention to the math class, you know? But if you're into history, you'll remember all the dates and times. It's that. This is my passion.
How do you test your work?
Oh, so, man, that is never ending and always evolving. But I've done, the standard, I guess you can buy the book, you have the American Bladesmith Society, of course. And, the American Bladesmith Society has their, I'm not a member of, the ABS, but I like what they do for the bladesmithing community. But they have the Journeyman Bladesmithing, strength integrity test, I believe it's called. I might be butchering that. But that's basically where they, you know, someone who is trying to go for their journeyman, certificate, portion of it, they have to bring in a blade in front of a master's smith, and they have to like chop through a 2x4, then cut through a 1-inch thick hemp rope, then have it shave hair, then chop through another 2x4, then they have to put it in a vise and bend it to 90 degrees without it breaking. And that is their strength integrity test. So I've done that numerous times, making sure I pass that. And, also too, you have the, you know, depending on what steels you're using, you have all the parameters you have to hit for a professional grade heat treat and tempering process. And so for that, you know, a big change for that for me was once I got kilns in my shop, I was able to change my, and this is how most smiths start off. Most smiths do their heat treat using a forge when they start out before they can buy a kiln or afford a kiln or before they bite the bullet and buy one. And for most of those people, they can get a relatively good heat treat, but it'll be nowhere near as good as what they can accomplish with a digitally controlled kiln for doing their thermal cycling and their heat treating and getting all their soak times for quench and whatnot. It makes a world of difference. And so for there, you know, you can do snap and break tests, what are destructive tests, to crack open a blade, you heat treat it and check the grain structure in there. And, yeah, I mean, it's huge. That is a deep pool.
You know, I was wondering, I saw the even heat kilns that you have?
Yes, sir.
And I was wondering, I just from Forged in Fire and from seeing live demos and stuff, that's where I see the heat treat just coming out of the forge and going into the oil. So I wasn't sure if I was seeing you, heat treating, a stainless stock removal blade. I couldn't tell what I was looking at, but
no. So, the recent one I did, that is just, my thermal fight one. So the vast majority of blades that I make, or that you see, I make them out of ABC-RB2. That is a high carbon steel. And, so what I am doing is I am thermal cycling them to make sure that all of the crystalline grain structure is all nice and aligned and as it should be, and that it shrinks the grain structure of the steel, because every time you heat it up, it swells. And the more it swells, the more brittle it gets. So if you were to snap the blade open, you know, quench it right there and snap it open, it would look like the granules of sugar or sand inside. Mm-hmm. And you don't want it. That's way too blown out. You want it nice and tight, very smooth and satin, like wet cement in there. And so thermal cycling helps shrink that grain structure down. And that's what, that was what I was using the kiln for in that post.
Okay. So that's the sort of the tempering process, but a little bit more complex. Have you ever gotten to the end of a complicated build, or just you got to the end of something you're very proud of and then it just somehow broke? Never happened?
So, I've only cracked like 3 blades and every single time I did it, it was a 1095 steel. which is a finicky steel. A lot of people love it. And honestly, my heat treating skills are so much better now that I could probably use it no problem. But I hate it just because, you know, I cracked 3 blades once upon a time within years ago. I've forged out, you know, complicated bars of mosaic Damascus and started cutting into it and saw that I had like welds that hadn't set. Mm-hmm. Oh, at certain parts up there, and so I was cutting cutting slices off of it, and I kept taking them and throwing them on the ground and watching them break apart into 4 pieces perfectly. And I ended up cutting like 4 inches off this one bar until I got to perfectly forged welded material, which made it, you know, the blade I was going to make was going to be this big, ended up being this big.
Oh, a little slip joint blade there.
Any smith that's putting out a good amount of material has a bucket, or in my case, like the bed of a truck full of, you know, rejects or failures or whatnot.
Well, that picture of the Kopesh, that's that curved ancient Egyptian sword, if you're not boned up on your historical swords, but, that very dramatic curved shape, made me wonder, what's the most complicated or difficult sword or build you've ever done?
Honestly, the Kopesh, that thing was a pain in the rear, man. That sucker was hard. Because not only, some customer I made that for, he wanted, because there's many different historical shapes to the Kopesh. You've got the big crescent moon, you've got and then it gets a little bit more subtle depending on like the different kingdoms and eras they had. And that curvature on there, man, grinding that was a bear. So this picture cracks me up. This is one of my buddies. This is what he does professionally. He makes custom posters and things like that. And so he did that to a picture of mine. But no, grinding that thing was like so rad as I was grinding it. Like I was driving an Edsel.
Maybe something better than an Edsel.
No, that big and bony.
Oh, I got you. Oh my gosh. Yeah. And so was that all forged out or did you cut that out?
No, that was forged out. And, keeping, keeping all that in line for me, keeping that in line for me was, keeping everything straight, because pulling that bar down and then wrapping it back around and trying to get that in there, it was not fun.
So if I'm a bladesmith and I'm new to it and I'm starting to spend the money, what is the machine that, or the tool that in your equipment that made the biggest difference in your productivity or in your knife making in general?
Honestly, and this is that's a great question, and I answer it the same way every time I get asked it. It's buy the nice tool the first time around. Don't do like I did. I bought all the cheap stuff the first time around, so I had to buy twice.
Yeah. That's not good.
But buy a nice, good, expensive 2x72 belt grinder. Because it doesn't matter if you are the best forger in the world. If you're the best bladesmith in the world and you forge your blades to 99% complete, if you can't grind well, no one's going to look at what you made. No one's going to want to buy it. It's not going to look good. So honestly, grinding is one of the most important skills, because that's going on everything you make. And if you don't have a good grinder, so having a crummy grinder and a good grinder makes a world of difference. You can ask anyone, like, hey, what was it like once you got your first nice 2x72 belt grinder? They're like, oh my gosh, it changed everything. It made everything so much better. Yeah.
Well, what about for a forger, a bladesmith? What about the power hammer?
Honestly, I think, and once again, I was one of those guys. I thought, I got to get a power hammer ASAP. I got to have a power hammer. And I've used them. I love them. If you've got the shop space for it, and if you have the money for it, go for it. All the power to you. You'll love it, and it'll be a wonderful tool in your shop. But Cole Ironworks changed that for so many people. So Cole Ironworks makes the hydraulic forging presses, and they corner the market on those. They have a beautiful design, and they make them in all these different strengths, like three or four different models now, and they're pretty affordable. You can move them around on casters around your shop. They don't take up a big footprint, and they're pretty darn quiet, and that's all I use. I have a small little two-car garage I do everything out of. I don't have the room for a power hammer.
Okay, so this press is, you're talking about, I'm going to refer to Forged in Fire again, because that's my most detailed context forging. You know how they pull out that stick of butter, all those different layers, and they put it in and they press it slowly before they start pounding it out. Is that what you're talking about, that kind of machine?
Yeah, that's a hydraulic forging press. And like I said, the company...
Different
the company,
from a hammer.
Yeah, different from a hammer. And the company's called Cole Ironworks. And if you pull them up, you'll look like every single bladesmith in the United States knows exactly who they are. Because they're the Kellogg's of that brand. Everyone knows who they are, and they're super nice people. And they make every guy's got one that has this smith. Every master smith's got one in their shop. they're like the first big expensive tool that most people buy nowadays.
Okay. Because that really eliminates the time of like trying to set the welds.
For forging Damascus steel, it's wonderful. Especially if you can't afford a power hammer, or you don't have the room for it, or even if you have the room for it, if you're in a residential area, and you can't be like causing a big ruckus, they're wonderful. They're worth every penny.
Wow. Well, okay. So as you you continue full time. Well, actually, I wanted to ask you before I even get to that. What is War Crown? How did you get the name? What does that mean? What's the significance?
I was a big fantasy fiction nerd, and one of my all time favorite authors is R.A. Salvatore. And R.A. Salvatore wrote a book series called The Legend of Dritz. The Legend of Dritz has about 40 plus novels involved in it now. And a very small literary character is a dwarven king in one of those books. He's in there for about a paragraph. And his last name is War Crown. And I remember reading that. And I read those books all the time. reread them all the time. And I was like, that's the coolest name ever. And so when I was first coming up with my names, you know, harking back 7.5 years ago, I was going through every realm of mythology trying to come up with a good name. Because my name's Justin Burton. I've got the only name more generic than mine is John Smith. So I couldn't, you know, there's Burton Knives, Burton Cutlery, J Ball Blades, JB Blades. My name's useless for, you know, brand recognition. And I didn't want to put a big JB on my blades either. And so I'm like, okay, what am I going to call my business? And so I went through all of Greek mythology. I went through all of Norse mythology. I went through them all. And then I'd research them. And I'd Google, and I mean, there's a dozen Valhalla forges.
And there's a Hephaestus forge.
Norse mythology is tapped out 1,000 times over. Greek mythology is close to it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Roman, so on and so forth. Like I said, Delph is darn near everything. I even went into, like, you know, Pacific Islander mythology and everything. And I was like, all right, none of this is going to work. And so I was reading that book. I came across it again. And so I emailed Ari Salvatore. And I never expected to hear from him, but I was like, hey, I'm Justin Burton. This is what I'm doing. I'd love to name my shop after this small character in the book. And about a week later, he emailed me back. He's like, I'm honored. Go for it. And I was like, all right, let's do this.
Wow. Yeah. I was going to say, what an honor, especially for someone, for whom swords are, you know, probably play big in those books, I would imagine.
Oh yeah. So, oh yeah. Huge.
You know, that's gotta be really cool.
Oh yeah. Yeah. They're all based in the Dungeons and Dragons realm. And, him emailing me back and giving me the go ahead was awesome. And that's also too a big thing. So every once in a blue moon, I'll have a customer that's like, "Oh, hey, you're an Ari Salvatore fan," and they know it, right? So it's out there. That always cracks me up too.
Well, who is your customer? Who do you find buys your work the most?
Man, well, I'd say the Battle Walk tends to be, like I said, as of the last year, the Battle Walk has probably been my most popular blade. And I have made those for a lot of veterans and active duty military. So I get a fair amount of veterans and active duty military. More than I have any right to. I've done them good, treated them well, and they, you know, word of mouth, spread, and I get a lot of friends and family from those interactions as well. And so that's huge, you know. Once again, with there being so many options out there, it's a huge blessing to be chosen or to be picked or to have the customer base I do. I'm very blessed.
Do you ever hear from your customers about reports from the field? Not, you know, I use my Wakizashi in battle, but like, do you ever hear of people using your knives out on duty or in the field?
So I have gotten several pictures, you know, lots of hunters. I've got lots of pictures of hunters using them, especially in Arizona for elk. And then I've gotten to see several pictures of some of my blades in country, in places like Afghanistan and places of that nature, which is pretty awesome. I think that's about it. Everything else is just more run of the mill, like, you know, camping photos or whatnot. And that's actually something I've done that in the past, but I'm planning on doing that again, which is another knife giveaway. And the only way to enter it is to post a picture of your Warcraft Forge blade, you know, which I think is fun.
Wait. Your what? Your Warcraft Forge? What's that mean?
Oh, no. My your Warcraft.
Oh, your Warcrown Forge blade. Yeah. I'm sorry.
No, you're fine.
I misheard you. Man. Well, that means I couldn't enter because I don't have one yet. So in terms of Warcrown Forge, the company, how would you like to see it grow? Do you ever plan on bringing other people in on this, or is this a sole authorship, project business?
So a batch of blades I'm currently working on right now. I am working on them with a friend of mine. So I've had numerous people want to be, you know, interested in coming into the shop and working with me. But you know, either the chemistry is not always there, or some people don't realize how hard of a, you know, how much work it actually is. Which I totally understand. You know, it's not for everyone, you know. But I have a guy in the shop with me currently, and we've been working on this new batch of blades that's getting ready to drop here in the next few days. And everything's been going really well, working really harmoniously. So I've got high hopes for that, because if that works out, then I can knock out my custom orders list, and then I can get on to what is kind of my dream for Warcraft Forge, which is blades available, you know, on the website all the time, drops, you know, special edition drops, you know, going like once a month or once every 2 months, and me just getting to make like crazy swords and all kinds of stuff. Because I've got in my brain now, after doing the tactical, the battle walk and the tactical gladius, I really want to make the like tactical, you know, ranger sword from Lord of the, like, what if Aragorn was an army ranger?
Right.
I've got so many more things I want to make that I just don't have time for, so I need the time.
Oh, man. Well, okay, before I let you go, the something that you made was, I mean, it was so impressive. That big, giant, double-bit battle axe. Tell me about that. And it almost, when you did a, you put it, posted a video rope testing. Holy mackerel. It looks like it was spun you almost all the way around. Tell us about this thing.
So this sucker is crazy and ridiculous. And it was, I had a customer reach out to me, and they wanted a giant battle axe for, to hang up in their podcast studio. And I told them, and I was like, they were like, it doesn't have to be functional. It doesn't have to be functional. It doesn't have to work. It's going to hang on the wall. And I was like, I can't send something out that's not functional. You know, I was like, I'll tell you what, like, here's the difference. I was like, first of all, these are not historically accurate unless you were like, you know, a headsman in Europe, you know, a headsman in Europe in like the 1400s, you know, that's the only time you would have seen an axe like this.
Right.
And I was like, all right, these axes are not meant to split wood all day. They'll take limbs off all day, but they're not meant for splitting wood all day. And so that's what I ended up making, that individual. And, you know, I did the rope cut test, and it was, you know, slice, it's razor sharp, it's dangerous, it's a ton of fun though. For being giant, oversized, and ridiculous, it's pretty balanced and fun to, wield around.
It's like straight out of a Boris Vallejo, illustration. As we wrap here, leave us with your knife making philosophy encapsulated in one small tidbit.
Oh, that's real easy. Better with every blade.
With every blade. I love it. No. Justin, thank you so much. Justin Burton of Warcrown Forge. Thank you so much for coming in. And, well, you didn't come in anywhere for talking with me here. It's been really cool getting to know you. I've been loving your work. I like your videos too. I just like the way you present them. You're always, you know, you come up to the camera, you show your work off, you can see what you're selling, and man, it looks so good. So I look forward to getting behind the wheel of a Warcrown Forge knife sometime in the future. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. Honestly, it's been a pleasure.
You know you're a knife junkie if you plan your vacation around Blade Show.
There he goes, ladies and gentlemen, Justin Burton of Warcrown Forge. Do yourself a favor and check him out on Instagram at Warcrown Forge. You can see these things we were talking about, the tactical gladius, the wakizashi, and all the other cool stuff he makes. Really, really beautiful stuff. Be sure to join us on Wednesday for the midweek supplemental and Thursday for Thursday Night Knives at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time right here on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitch. For Jim working his magic behind the switcher, I'm Bob DeMarco saying until next time, don't take dull for an answer.
Thanks for listening to the Knife Junkie Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please rate and review at reviewthepodcast.com. For show notes for today's episode, additional resources, and to listen to past episodes, visit our website, theknifejunkie.com. You can also watch our latest videos on YouTube at theknifejunkie.com/YouTube. Check out some great knife photos on theknifejunkie.com/Instagram and join our Facebook group at theknifejunkie.com/Facebook. And if you have a question or comment, email them to bob@theknifejunkie.com or call our 24/7 listener line at 724-466-4487. And you may hear your comment or question answered on an upcoming episode of the Knife Junkie Podcast.